thanks so much for your time. As always, this is Peter Brindley with Leon Baker, and we're going to talk about artificial intelligence. Why? Because we're at the Toronto Critical Care Canada Forum, and we've just had a fantastic plenary session on that. And so we have two of the people who are on that panel, the magnificent, glorious Flamingoed today. Nice top you're wearing.
Thank you.
Shelley Dev, who's been with us before, and the equally radiant, ebullient, spectacular David Maslow from Kingston. All right, guys. Leon, ask these people a mean question to kick us off.
Ooh, it's an easy one, I guess. AI, help us out. What is it?
Yeah, that's an easy one.
Yeah, so perhaps in the eye and the beholder a little bit, and it's probably a question that is where the answer is evolving. And if you had asked a year ago, it would have been, well, I always think of, there was a student that I worked with in grad school who had done his undergrad working with robots in Berkeley, and he invented or helped develop a little robot arm that could pick up a dish towel and fold it. And I thought, well, that's intelligence, right? Because it's not a very complicated task, but you definitely have to make some decisions and find the edge and the corner. And, you know, it took 45 minutes to fold a dish towel, but it did it. And it was a robot arm. And I thought that's pretty cool. That's pretty intelligent. Now, I think the reason why there's so much interest in this topic is because of these generative artificial intelligences that seem to at least paint paintings and write prose and so on and so forth. So most people, I think, would put that in the category as well. And then others would push back on whether that's actually a true intelligence.
Now, Shelley, you're here because you've also got tons of GI, genuine intelligence. You know, we don't even really well-defined intelligence in human beings. And we come up with all sorts of, well, this person's got emotional intelligence and this person's got numeric intelligence. So can we really define it in computers if we can't define it in ourselves? I mean, you started the session out with a picture, or rather a piece of 2001, A Space Odyssey, a bit of HAL.
Yeah.
That is what a lot of people think of when they think of the March of the Machines.
Yeah. So I was on this panel as a moderator, and so not as anybody who's in the know about it, but to represent what I think is, you know, your baseline level of understanding of what this is, which is, you know, dreadful and ominous, because I, like most intelligent people, get all of my information from the movies. But what was really informative for me in listening to the panelists and having discussions with them after is this idea that so much of what we do in medicine is rather robotic. And that is not the reason most of us, save for the sociopaths, got into medicine, right? And we got into medicine to explore that basic fundamental unit of interaction, which is between you and the patient. I always say on rounds, like in the ICU, is that the distance between you and the patient should be like nothing. But there's so much distance between us and them with these tasks and these things that we just do and compile and search. And it kind of, you know, like I flipped the switch for myself and thinking like, well, wait a minute, maybe the GI, as you said, the genuine intelligence, with the help of kind of offsetting these repetitive mundane things, we'd allow that to flourish more. And I think the people who will be worried about this are the people who derive genuine satisfaction and self-esteem from these bleeping robotic things.
Well, if I can push back on that a little bit, and David, let's bring you back in.
Still trying to figure out who gets pleasure from these robotic tasks, which of my colleagues are happy to check through a tick box of things, but maybe they're there.
Let's be honest, there are plenty of people whose job is to maintain their job and stay in position. And if that means being an obstacle to others or just doing a repetitive task in order for a paycheck and social prestige, they'll keep doing it. You know, I dream of a world where I don't have to write a robotic note every day and I don't have to show I've reviewed all the blood work every day. I can scan it. But it hasn't been my experience that that's what healthcare has done. You know, with all of the promise, this conference seems to be suggesting what I fear is that we're moving further away from holding hands and more towards high technology, low touch, as the expression keeps being uttered.
Absolutely. And I think it raises two interesting points, which is one that, maybe the AI can help with some of these really awful rote things that I do. But we also should at least take the opportunity to ask why we're being asked to do these rote things. That can be anything from, writing notes to employers when maybe there's a simpler way to do that, or there's a more efficient form that we could attest to the fact that someone's been in the hospital, to instead of getting the AI to review reams and reams of blood work every day, maybe take a step back and ask why we've ordered reams and reams of blood work every day. And it allows us to crystallize what those rote and sort of routine repetitive tasks are in our workflow, and maybe be a bit more ambitious, not just outsourcing them to a robot, but wondering why they're there to begin with.
If I can just quickly go through, I mean, the good and the great were on that panel and everybody made good points. And so shout out to Michelle Chassé, who made the point that we need guardrails and that we need to engage. Now, having said that, I'm not too sure who we is. Is we Silicon Valley or is we government? Because I'm kind of equally scared of both groups. Dominic Piquette made a great point that AI doesn't seem to say I don't know or offer that it's uncertain. And that could have its own problems. Patrick seems quite excited about it and says it's no different than when the calculator came along and there was moral panic there. But I would push back and suggest that when something's generating its own questions and, once the toothpaste is already out of the tube to the extent that AI is, that there might be more to it than that.
Giving everyone the benefit of the doubt, I think the we is probably we as a profession, capital P writ large. I guess I can't know that for sure, but that we as the ultimate responsible agents here have a role to play so that those other groups that you mentioned don't run away with the whole thing.
Yeah, and to keep going with the panel of luminaries, I mean, Terry Howe made a great point that it helps us examine all of the silly stuff we currently do. And in fact, we assume we know what the baseline function is of our patient. For example, why don't we download data that says how many steps that person walked or what programs they're enrolled in? There are obviously confidentiality issues, but it's a very, very good point. And Andrew Baker, I mean, made the audience titter by pointing out that Hallmark is kind of a ChatGPT and that it gives you a sentiment. You go, yeah, that's good enough. I can put my name behind that. And maybe much of AI is just that and its natural progression. I mean, Shelley, are we doomed? Are we? Because you did say you didn't want to still be in the profession when this thing was fully realized.
What I said was, I hope I'm dead and gone.
Yeah, well.
So presumably I would have left the profession far before this. But I don't, honestly, I think going into listening to the panelists, the doom was higher up. I really am interested in this notion of, if I look at it from my lens of, I'm so interested in mental health and burnout and all this stuff. A huge metric that doesn't get better when people's burnout is better, one that's hard to move, is this feeling that there's no meaning in what you're doing and do you matter? And I think that when we talk about the way notes are written or the way we see them in computers, when we look at somebody's clinical note, there is no physicianship in those notes.
That's correct.
Right?
Cut and paste,
yes,
or
and
nonsense
that is
continued.
Because what we are valuing by the way in which we aren't paying attention to this already, but by how we, what we praise and what we don't praise, for the learners at least, is to do this. Just cut and paste and make a really long note. Mm-hmm. And a fantastic physician note and a useful physician note is, I am worried about X, and I think what I'm going to do is try Y and Z. I'll circle back and see. This could also be a possibility. That is what we should be doing. So for me, if there is a way for us to devalue certain tasks by offloading it to a system, then that increases the value of the things we ought to be valuing, right? Which is relationships with the patient, with the team, checking in with how's everybody dealing with the fact that we're going to be taking care of more and more and more and more patients. all we're going to do is take care of them more poorly if we do it the way we're doing.
Well, I'm very concerned about our communication, especially in notes. I mean, I've been promoting this idea of actually writing a dying certificate as much as a death certificate in charts, because it's just constant, you know, the sats are this, the oxygen levels this, the urine outputs this. Yeah, but where are we going and what does it all mean?
What does it mean? Like,
with that in mind, the only person on the panel I haven't mentioned is John Granton. And that's unfair, because John's a very wise man and taught me that, amongst many things, MD stands for make a decision. There is a danger. We sort of stop making decisions. We just put ourselves somewhere in this continuum of data that is pouring out of a machine, and we say, well, the machine decided, and I don't really understand it. It's like magic to me. I don't know where this came from, but ho-hum, that's what the machine says. And if I follow the machine, I won't get sued. And
I think we've been on this path anyway of what I would call, and I'm sure somebody else has come up with this before, is the listification of our job. There was this era in the 2000s where there were five big trials that were going to cure sepsis and were going to heal the lungs, and it was going to change the survival of all of these people who were in critical care. And we put them in our pre-printed orders. That's how much we believed in them, right? And they became shit to just check off, check off, check off. The algorithmic approach to complex physiology and nuanced illnesses, we've already been drawn to this at our peril. We're not appreciating the beauty of the nuance of this job. It's no surprise that we disavow even offering an opinion. It's like, okay, do you want the ventilator? Do you want CPR? We have scripts for this shit, right? We teach it that way. Here's how you be empathic. Eye level, crouch, stick the landing. It's garbage, right? So I think that we've already done this, and I think it would be absolutely ignorant of us to say we're not already doing this, right? So let's do it better.
I think a lot of AI is already there. There's a lot that we can use. And I want to take it back to the note writing that we do and the note bloat that you guys described of just filling in data all the time without a good synthesis. And I have a friend in emergency medicine who really speaks his note into being as such. While he's examining his patient, he has an AI system listening in, and that generates a fairly good note, perhaps not with a very good synthesis, but it's already there. It's being used. It may not be widespread in our everyday use EMRs and stuff, but it's certainly there. And I guess that does bring me to my question. I mean, the future of AI in medicine, you know, if you consider the average physician being what we are expected from our colleges, being a researcher, a clinician, as well as a teacher, is there any facet that is not going to be touched by AI?
Mm. Well, I guess it again depends on that definition. And I would almost push back and say that this voice recognition is not an AI. It's just a transcription tool. And that perfectly illustrates the narrow, potentially, pathway for some of these machine-based systems to help us out and to bring us back to the bedside, because this is now a clinician who's not seeking out a workstation on wheels or a computer somewhere to type all this information down. They found a much more efficient way to do it that is built into their workflow.
But I do want to say, I think there is a little bit of intelligence behind it, machine intelligence, of learned intelligence, because the way that this note gets written then, it certainly would suggest that somebody sat down afterwards and wrote things like right upper quadrant, non-tender. While he doesn't have to dictate that directly, he would just say, does it hurt when I push in this area? And it would get changed. So there's got to be a little bit of intelligence behind it, surely.
Plus, it's got to scrub out all the swear words.
Dr. Dev's note, clearly. What about the sort of garbage in, garbage out? I mean, let's accept, first of all, we do have lots of robots in the ICU. That's what a ventilator is, for goodness sake. We write our papers, they have autocorrect, and they make suggestions. So let's not be too pious here. But garbage in, garbage out. There's these awful famous examples of Facebook becoming pretty racist pretty fast. And you know, there's hypothetical examples of, I don't know, there's a car swerve that's driving itself, and do you allow it to hit the old lady before the young child? And then you send an AI machine to get your coffee, and it kills everyone in the line because that gets it to the front of the line faster, or it spends $1 million on the coffee. They've got a lot of hypothetical and some of it moral panic, but it's garbage in, garbage out. So there's an element where artificial intelligence, until it becomes generative, and that's terrifying on a different level, it's still are biases further amplified and further distilled, is it not?
Absolutely. I think there's two different questions there. One is this mostly the garbage out question is whether some of that will just be self-correcting. So there's a lot of discussion about, does it matter if ChatGPT writes your introduction or your discussion in your paper? And people want that disclosed. I'm not even sure why they want that disclosed. It's probably going to be a lousy introduction. And you'll be able to tell that it was written by a robot because it's going to be pretty rote and it's going to be regurgitative and it's not going to be interesting to read. So some of that may be much ado about nothing, and that people will, find that it's easy to use these things because it eliminates the fear of the blank page, but the ultimate product, they're going to end up rewriting anyway. It may have a different role or a more useful role for people whose first language is in English, and that could be a separate thing. The second problem is the garbage in problem, which I think is a legitimate problem, and sorting out where that data comes from and how to ensure that that data is representative is probably, frankly, a sort of insidious problem that'll be hard to solve.
Back to you, Shelley. We're at a conference, for goodness sake. We could all do this online, but we're here because we like interacting with people. We like poetry. We like a clever expression. We like a smile on somebody's face. And you've already alluded to this. Can we maintain the two together, or is it, the computer versus the human? Is it Hal?
I think it's more informative if we're doing the movie thing to look at WALL-E, right? This is a very prescient thing. This movie, I urge you all to check it out. This is a brilliantly, beautifully observed film, which is human longing and desire to connect will always win. It just will, right? And so I think this will permit that so much more because I will be disentangled from the stuff that I did not sign up for in doing this job, right? It will allow for more relationship-based interaction with your team, with the patient. I don't know. This is my best hope, right? But I don't think we're ever going to not want to be together.
I think we'll definitely want to be together. And some of the mental health issues we're seeing are signs of people losing community or an online community being a pretty poor replacement for
Absolutely.
A good old fashioned. Again, though, I would love to believe it's going to free up all of our time to be more human, but it hasn't been my experience. Well, my rounds are that we nurse the computer more and more and the patient less and less.
But I think this is about us choosing not to be deliberate and purposeful about the way in which we engage with things. So what I find really interesting that I've kind of ventured into is just reading really smart work by social scientists in the States who talk about time and the concept of time as time affluence, your perception that you have a lot of it, not what the actual time is, but that you have it to give to things that you want to do versus time poverty. And a wonderful term that comes out of there from the work of a woman named Bridget Schulte, who wrote this great book called, I think, Overworked, and talking about social currency being busyness, she has this term that she coined called time confetti, which is the fragmentation of units of time. When our smartphones came out, or whatever, right? When all that proliferated, we were excited because things will be easier now, right? You can answer things quicker. You can get to things quicker. What ends up happening is this perception that I don't have as much time as I used to because I'm always on this thing.
Indeed.
And so social scientists who study time say, it's this autonomy paradox, right? Where you actually, that's what they call it, is that you want the technology to make your life easier, but it's not because you are choosing to engage with it constantly. Right? So we're relinquishing our agency. It's like, yes, it is a choice to put the computer away. On my rounds, I ask that we not round with the computer, right? Yes, it's unpopular. Fine, right? But the thing is that there's no such thing as multitasking. We have made bad decisions, and it's no wonder that we're suffering because of it. So our big problem is we're not learning from how we've mishandled whatever technology we already have.
I think your point about agency, it's coming up on podcast after podcast that it really is one of the things that matters. The patients, if they still have agency, you're still in with a fight and it still seems like an honorable thing to do. If healthcare workers still have agency, they don't just do things to do things. And so I think you're onto something really, really important. We say a choice, and of course there is a choice. And as a parent, I'm forever telling my kids, you make a choice. But there are some pretty insidious things that influence our choices. Mm-hmm. You know, we narrow our focus based on what's delivered to us. And so mm-hmm. we make choices within that. And we do what the rest of the tribe is doing and if the rest of the tribe is influenced. So we're going to have to make a very conscious decision to engage with this issue and work out what matters, sit down as a group, set some goalposts. Having said that, the toothpaste is kind of out of the tube, isn't it, David? We're going to let you round this off.
A little bit, but it's interesting. I mean, I think Shelley's exactly right. And the question is how to address these concerns, whether more technology is the answer. And maybe it's not. Maybe we can exert this agency and take control of our time and force ourselves back to the bedside without having to outsource those tasks and just see what happens to those tasks.
I think that's right, David. It's just like we're behaving as though, well, this is going to railroad me right over. It's like, what the hell? Like, show up, mm-hmm. right? Show up. And, you know, another segue I'll make is into the area of, well, I was speaking about at the conference, is this note mindfulness of what it actually means. Truly, what I had to learn through learning about it is it's about paying attention. It's about noticing what is happening and being curious about what it is you're noticing. The analogy that is used or that I use when I'm talking about it is a stream of consciousness that carries your emotions, your thoughts, your sensations, whatever, right? It is constantly going and we are in it all the time instead of stepping out of it at the bank and watching and looking and paying attention and noticing, right? Being curious about it and then deciding what to do. And we are behaving as though, well, I have no choice. This shit is going to happen to me. You do have a choice. And it's just like it's relinquishing your agency.
For those doing shots every time Shelley says the S word, that's the third one. Shelley, I love talking to you. I don't care what the topic is because I always learn something.
Ditto.
Last, and that's not true.
No, it isn't.
Last time we spoke, the words that have really resonated with me for the last 6 months have been lack of imagination, that we often just do things because we do things. And I think you've made that point beautifully, that we think we're in a stream. There's nothing we can do about it. So David, back to you as we close this down. I'm going to let Leon close it down. But I don't know, what does success look like? I mean, I sound like I'm doing your annual report now. But what's success look like in 5 years?
We all have as much time as we want to do the things that we want to do. We can worry Bravo. Less about, you know, ticking boxes and getting things that someone tells us need to be done. I think the question, just to bring it back to the original sort of premise of the discussion, is whether AI has anything to do with that at all, or whether that's just a change in our practice, and it's something that you've already started to do by insisting there are no computers at rounds. It's something that I try to do by insisting that we use paper charts, and I try to write the notes myself so that I'm not writing down what the SAT was, writing down what the heart rate was. I'm just writing down what we think is happening here and where we should go from here. So there are probably ways to do that without outsourcing busy work to an artificial intelligence. And that's kind of a empowering and an exciting thought because we could do that tomorrow.
Yeah. But I want to add to that. I'm sorry, I'm still on this note writing thing and note bloat and so on. But I don't know if you've experienced this where you have a resident on rounds or a couple of residents on rounds and they are so focused and just they have zero bandwidth for anything else. They need that note to be absolutely perfect. And I think that is a perfect place for AI to step in and just take that bandwidth and write the note. If there's a button that they can press to generate note and they only have to write the synthesis, mm-hmm. I think that'll be brilliant.
But who's going to read that note?
Yeah, is it a perfect note or is it just a long, comprehensive note?
What's our definition of a good note here? And no, that's success, 100%. Right? That doesn't matter.
That's a good point.
Should we all just beat up on Leon now?
I'm talking about taking the bandwidth and using that rather than on patient care instead of 80% of what you're thinking about is just making this
right. Absolutely. But remember, that comes from this cultural valuing of this process, right? We live in the culture, but we create the culture, right? So if I say, when you're writing the notes, all I want in your note is, here's what I think is going on.
It also enables avoidant behavior because the trainee thinks I've written this great, like this note is 2 pages long. It's gotta be a great note. So it must be good.
But the hit the target, miss the point thing is my biggest worry about this glorious profession.
I actually remember, I wish I could credit the guy who once said this to me, but it was a CIO somewhere who thought, you know, like if the point was just to communicate to others what's going on with the patient and where everyone is on this, you'd be much better off giving that patient a Facebook page, basically, that, and we can all write on their wall. I don't know how Facebook works, but you know, you could communicate this through very different means. And if you had to invent it from the start, you wouldn't invent a chart, basically. You would invent some other system to communicate.
Well, good friend of this podcast, Matt Morgan, is writing notes to the patient almost as if it's a letter. And it's an intriguing idea because it engages the person we claim to be at the center.
Honestly, and it actually, like, that has deep roots in reflective practice, right? It really does. And you know, people were writing about these things like a long time ago because this is the essence of what gives us meaning in the work. And so what I'll say is, if nothing else, being confronted with the possibility of even more technology, if it's allowing us to kind of say, wait and re-examine and interrogate the way we're doing things already, then great. I think that's great. I think this conversation is great for that reason. Mm-hmm.
I think it's not great. Because I worry that it's doing what the, and we agree, I'm just being
provocative. No, I get it. Yeah.
You know, there's a reception going on right now, David.
It's reinforcing this lack of agency that Patrick and that was talking about, you know, that we need to be at the table to tell the companies that are making these products what we need from them. And we weren't there when the EMRs were doing this. And so the EMRs
I completely agree. I'm sorry, I cut you off there. But I feel like we're saying the same thing, is that
exactly
the fact that this looms means we say, wait a minute, right? We've seen this before, and I need to be part of this. I need to be on the board making these decisions, right? And physicians in general, at least in this country, are really shitty activists, right? Like, we need to put ourselves in the roles of making the policy, right?
The danger is of the company saying, we can use AI to make this EMR workflow better for you without asking why this EMR workflow is the way it is to begin with.
Yes.
Can I drop this mic?
Look at Dave dropping the mic.
I wonder how long until AI can have a conversation like this. Maybe this is still the thing that humans can do that machines can't. Leon.
We're adding impetus for learning right now, so it might.
I love that we talk like we know what we're talking about. Over to you. Maybe that's artificial fabrication.
We need to wrap this up, but maybe in 30 seconds or less, what does the ideal AI-empowered intensivist of the future look like? Shelley, we'll start with you and then go to Dave.
It looks like the person who spends way more time in the room with the patient than they do right now. Is that the chief amount of time that they spend is either with the patient or talking to the learners and actually rediscovering the meaning of this whole thing.
There's a mic drop.
I couldn't agree more.
No, I can't.
And I think to encapsulate that, it's the intensivist who isn't worried about what the AI is doing. They're otherwise occupied.
Well, thank you so much for this discussion, guys. It's been a blast.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Health information offered on the Critical Care Commute podcast and the resources available for download through the podcast and show notes is provided for general informational and educational purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the hosts, guests, or any individuals featured on this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the hosts or their employers.